This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 6th of September 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, what's to be gained from APEC? We'll be discussing the value of the meeting as it kicks off in Vladivostok.
We have the meetings between the Russian president, Chinese president, Japanese president and South Korea. At this APEC, this is very much an Asian meeting with Russia as the extra partner.
That was Dennis Shanahan. Also in the programme...
The scope of today's announcement took a lot of people by surprise. It's a sweeping, if not a seismic change, the way Qantas does business.
That's what David Flynn, editor of Australian Business Traveller, makes of the Qantas and Emirates new 10-year alliance. But what will this mean for the future of Singapore Airport? We'll be putting that question to Christopher Jasper, Bloomberg's aviation editor, and also getting some reflections from our editor-in-chief. And as Air India announces plans to sell off its art collection, we'll explore the current state of the corporate art market with Jane Morris, editor of the Art newspaper. Plus, who were the winners and losers from the dot-com bubble and where are they now? A new book asks just that and hopefully answers it too. We'll be speaking to its author, Andrew Smith. And as ever, music too. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24. So welcome one and all. But first, before any of that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
The Arab League chief Nabil El Arabi has said today that the new international envoy to Syria planned to take a different approach to his predecessor in a bid to bring an end to the ongoing conflict there. The new UN and Arab League mediator Lakhdar Brahimi replaced Kofi Annan in late August and will travel to Cairo on Sunday. El Arabi said Brahimi planned a period of careful study before beginning any negotiations.
He wants to take his time to see what is possible, how can it be achieved, and he's entitled to have time because it's so complicated and he will need some time to chart a new course, let's put it that way.
In South Africa, a jubilant group of miners who were arrested following clashes with police at Lonmin's Marikana mine were released today after appearing in the local magistrate court. The group of 102 men were freed without having to post bail but will appear in court again on the 12th of February next year. Another group of 162 men were released on Monday after their murder charges were also dropped. Many of the miners alleged they were abused by police while in holding cells. New Zealand's foreign minister has defended his country's own proposal for the marine protection area in the Ross Sea region tonight, following criticism from environmentalists. Murray McCulley said that New Zealand is pushing ahead with an independent proposal for the marine reserve in the Ross Sea after it pulled out of a joint plan with the United States.
New Zealand has a range of complex interests, spanning conservation as well as science. And research as well as the fishing interests we have as well. And we decided that at the initial stages of this process we would submit our own proposal, but I've given a firm commitment to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that we will work closely with the US.
Colombian leaders have held a news conference today in Cuba's capital, Havana. The largest guerrilla group in Colombia will propose a ceasefire upon meeting with government officials for peace talks in Oslo in October. A decade after the last attempt to end Latin America's longest-running insurgency failed, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos is betting the FARC will agree to bring an end to a war that has killed tens of thousands since starting in 1964. The former President Bill Clinton addressed the Democratic National Convention last night in North Carolina to formally propose Barack Obama as the party's nominee for November's presidential election. He defended Mr. Obama's policies, saying his economic record had been a success.
He inherited a deeply damaged economy. He put a floor under the crash. He began the long, hard road to recovery and laid the foundation for a modern, more well-balanced economy that will produce millions of good new jobs, vibrant new businesses, and lots of new wealth for innovators. Now, are we where we want to be today? No. Is the president satisfied? Of course not. But are we better off than we were when he took office?
President Obama will make his argument for re-election tonight in a high-profile closing act at that Democratic National Convention that he will use to spell out his plans to try to revitalize the stumbling US economy. And finally, summing up the life of a dearly departed relative with just a terse description etched in stone may become a thing of the past with the introduction of interactive codes on gravestones. One funeral company in the southern English town of Poole is offering to add so-called quick response codes to headstones, which will link smartphones to online memorials illustrated with pictures, videos, and contributions from family and friends. The funeral directors there said the QR barcodes would enable visitors to learn a lot more about the person buried beneath gravestones than the age, dates of birth and death, and the odd biblical passage or literary quote usually written on them. And those are the stories on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much. I really can't think of anything more hideous to have on a gravestone than a QR code. But there we are. Thank you for that, Jonathan. It is 21:06 in Moscow, 18:06 here in London, 13:06 in Toronto. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And it's Midori House on Monocle 24. Heads of state and foreign ministers from around the Pacific Rim are beginning to gather in Vladivostok for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, as it's better known. Vladimir Putin took a little detour on his way, donning a white suit and taking flight in a hand glider to help birds migrate across northern Siberia. As you do. The others took a more traditional route. The presidential 747s are already beginning to line up on the apron at Vladivostok International. But is there much point in any of them turning up at all? Maybe not. APEC has been around for 23 years, but perhaps due to its slightly odd collection of members, it has never become much more than a talking shop. A little earlier, I spoke to Dennis Shanahan, who is in Vladivostok. He's a political editor for The Australian, and I asked him what big things we can expect.
There's not a great deal from the strict APEC agenda that we can expect over the next couple of days. APEC is not strictly a trade organisation. Its meetings are also governed and dominated by what's occurring at the time. And right now, because President Obama is not coming from and Japan is not so keen, the whole idea of trade and the Trans-Pacific Partnership fallen by the wayside. But in the meantime, Russia is taking a great deal of advantage in hosting APEC, citing APEC, and that is Vladivostok as well. We have the idea that there are meetings of Japanese, Chinese, Korean, and Russian about disputed territories.
Let's talk about some of those bilaterals that are likely to be happening, which is where, you know, some of the more interesting stuff is likely to be happening. Who is expected to be meeting whom on the sidelines of APEC?
Well, at the moment, because President Obama's not coming, Hillary Clinton will be meeting a number of people, but she's already been to Indonesia, she's already been to the South Pacific. Now, Hillary Clinton's view at APEC is trying to emphasise the US view of being a pivot in Asia without trying to close in China. But since the APEC is hosted in Russia, Vladimir Putin is putting a very big print on this APEC meeting, and we have the meetings between the Russian president, Chinese president, Japanese president and South Korea. At this APEC, this is very much an Asian meeting with Russia as the extra partner, partly because of the disputed territories in various parts of Asia between Japan, China, Korea and Russia.
You mentioned that Russia wants to promote Vladivostok as the gateway to the Pacific, and obviously they've spent a fair bit of cash on the city to spruce it up. How have you found it there over the last few days, or walking around? What does the city look and feel like?
Well, look, the nature of APEC is that you come into a bubble. I've come into a bubble today, or over the last few days, where I wasn't allowed to come. When I last came to Russia, Vladivostok was a closed port. Now it's open. The president is trying to symbolise that opening, and we've seen various YouTube shots today of him travelling with cranes migrating to the south in an ultralight plane. I mean, it seems that Vladimir Putin is prepared to go that extra step, and he's been playing up the opening up of Vladivostok. The university where I'm staying, which isn't quite up to the normal standards of an APEC accommodation, but in Vladivostok, it is a symbol of the gateway to come and the opening up of higher education through the Asia-Pacific Forum. It is also, for President Putin, an opportunity to demonstrate how he is part of the people and part of the migration to the Asia-Pacific. And this afternoon, he was demonstrating that by walking through the media centre, sitting down amongst the workers, the media people, and having a cup of coffee.
That was Denis Shanahan in Vladivostok, sharing a cup of coffee with Vladimir Putin. We're talking Qantas next. This is Midori House.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Those.
You are cordially invited to tune into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, we get some cultural offerings from the Venice Architecture Biennale and test our fortunes with a unique character from the old American fairground.
It's fascinating to see school-aged children just look up and wonder what she's going to say.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Marseille, renowned for its multicultural makeup and hard edges, is a city being reshaped. To discover the beating heart of Marseille, Monocle Films visits three hoteliers who reflect the evolution of this heady Mediterranean city: Au Vieux Panier, Le Petit Nice, and Hotel Le Corbusier.
I always used to say that we are here to share our passion. Here we are so proud of the building, so emotionally attached to the work of Le Corbusier that we are proud of it and we want to share it.
Marseille in Motion, Monocle Films on monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House, 1813 here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Qantas's decision to ditch its alliance with British Airways and link up instead with Emirates is bad news, not just for poor old BA. As part of the deal, Qantas will shift its long-haul hub from Singapore to Dubai. Qantas is currently the second biggest customer at Changi Airport, so short-term it could prove a problem for Singapore. Long-term, though, Changi may be all right. A host of other airlines are likely to be interested in Qantas's old slots. And meanwhile, work on a new terminal, that's Changi's fourth, begins next year and is expected to be completed by 2017. In a moment, we'll talk to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. But first, here's Chris Jesper, European aviation editor of Bloomberg. Chris, what do you make of this for Singapore? What does it mean for them?
I think it's a mixed picture, Steve. The fact is that they will lose some connectivity to Europe on what's universally known, of course, as the kangaroo route from Australia. But at the same time, it appears that Qantas plans to focus more of its Asian traffic, serving other destinations in Southeast Asia and also on to Northeast Asia and beyond in Singapore. So while there'll certainly be that loss of connectivity, as you say, there are plenty of airlines that are likely to step into the breach, and Singapore Airlines itself is a major international operator, of course. But We understand that Emirates wants to increase Asian connectivity by about 25%. So the picture will probably be that if you want to fly to Europe with Qantas, then yes, you are going to go via Dubai, but you will still go via Singapore to a host of Asian cities.
Well, let's talk about those other airlines that might want some of Qantas's old slots. I mean, who are the contenders? Who are the people that are looking to expand and would be interested in taking up some of that slack?
Well, depends where people are trying to get to, of course. Singapore is well placed, close to the equator. It is at a natural crossroads from Australasia to South Asia, Northeast Asia, and so on. So perhaps some of the North Asian operators, Chinese carriers that are emerging, also Indian operators. Indian's airline sector is struggling at the moment, but nevertheless, there's obviously a big emerging powerhouse there, and businesses will be seeking better connectivity, and Singapore's a place that they could find that.
And what does this mean in terms for alliances themselves? Because, I mean, obviously a lot of them have been, put together at some time ago. This one that, you know, between BA and Qantas was signed in 1995. Obviously the world has changed somewhat since then. Are there other alliances which you think a lot of major airlines are looking at now and going, you know, does this really serve our needs right now?
Well, it's certainly a sign of changing realities. Obviously, the links between the UK and Australia, are as old as the country. But from BA's point of view, while this was an important link, East Asia, Southeast Asia are becoming much more important than Australia itself. So we know that BA is out there seeking alternative partners, and it's said already that it's likely to focus more on Asian connectivity than simply trying to replace these connections with Australia. There are really two kinds of alliance in the world at the moment. One is the simple global alliance, which we hear so much about, Star and One World and SkyTeam. BA and Qantas are both One World members, and they will remain as such and will continue to co-chair as they've always done. What's ceasing here is revenue sharing. It's a much deeper form of alliance in which carriers share cost and sales and can actually align timetables and pricing and require antitrust immunity to do so. And that seems to be the shape of things to come, and it's an arena in which the Gulf carriers can compete. They're able to link up and seek this kind of partnership without having to join global alliances, which they've always felt aren't really dovetailed to their requirements. So we're likely to see more of that. Revenue-sharing alliance is certainly much more productive in terms of benefits to the bottom line, perhaps, than global alliances, which, are all about access to lounges and so on.
Chris Jesper, European aviation editor of Bloomberg, thank you very much indeed. We're going across now to Zurich and speak to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Tyler, what do you make of this deal? Is this overall bad news, you think, for Singapore?
I think it doesn't bode well for Singapore right now because, oftentimes, we're in an election year in America, and people talk, Steve, in terms of the flyover states in America going from the East Coast to West Coast, all that bit in the middle. And I think that Singapore finds itself, becoming a flyover city state in a way, because on one side it's challenged by technology. You have, longer range aircraft. It was always traditionally this hub, and then you have this very aggressive challenger that has emerged in the form of Emirates with its hub at Dubai. So I'm not so convinced that there's going to be such a land grab going on for those slots out of Changi. And I would be a little bit worried if I had, well beyond having broken ground on a fourth terminal, I'd be sort of worried about how many gates I've already ordered and my capacity issues.
And what's the attraction if you're Qantas to go with Dubai? Is it simply because it's a deal with Emirates, so therefore Dubai literally comes with it? Or is there actually a big advantage to them having their hub in Dubai rather than Singapore?
I think there are two things, Steve. I mean, originally, of course, you needed Singapore because it just made more sense from a connectivity point of view. You know, within the region, you could jump off, especially when you talk about business travel, people could then jump off in Singapore, they could make their way elsewhere, or, you know, of course, they could carry on down to Brisbane, you know, Melbourne, Sydney, etc. So, and then there was also range issues of aircraft. Now aircraft can jump, if they're heading towards Europe, of course, going against the winds, they can actually reach Dubai, no problem. And that was not the case, you know, if we rewind, you know, even, you know, 20, 25 years ago, if you looked at the Kangaroo at that point. So you know, Dubai, you know, works on that side. The other thing that Qantas gains coming into Europe, look at just the UK, for example, the amount of places that Emirates connects to. So you can bring people, you know, up from Melbourne or Sydney, and then you can take them direct. They don't have to do another jump through Heathrow. You know, they can go straight into Glasgow. They can go straight up to Leeds. And that's something you simply, you know, you cannot do under the One World arrangement at the moment. I think when you're talking to the gentleman from Bloomberg earlier, I'm not convinced that One World is going to exist as we know it. I see this as a bit of a come to mama right now. Come to Emirates. We are the world. You know, we carry more passengers internationally than any other airline in the world now. And I think that this could be really the unraveling of potentially a series of alliances. Qantas jumps in. They tie up, that region of APAC. Maybe they bring in another carrier from Northeast Asia. And I think this is it's important to make the point. Emirates is non-aligned. It is, you know, it's incredible. Here is an aviation brand that is not part of a global alliance. So I think this is the first mark of them setting up their own global alliance.
Tali Brûlé in Zurich, thank you very much indeed. We're going to play a song now. And since, you know, BA and Qantas are going their separate ways, this is Got You with Somebody I Used to Know. Said that you could let it go, and I wouldn't catch you hung up on somebody that you used to know. But you didn't have to cut me off, because like it never happened before. We were nothing. I need your love, but you treat me like a stranger, and I feel so rough. I didn't have to stop. That was Gautier, Somebody I Used to Know. You're with Midori House. There is a battle raging today across the Russian border. It's being fought through the car assembly plants of Moscow and Kiev. And the weapon of choice is a new type of import tax, like the one recently created by Russia. Moscow isn't supposed to be applying big import taxes. It's against the rules of the World Trade Organization, which Russia's just joined. So this levy has a different name, a utilization fee. But the effect is the same, pricing Ukrainian models out of Russian homes. And no surprises, now Ukraine's announced it's going to fire back with a tax all of its own. They're calling it a car recycling fee. This isn't the first trade conflict of 2012. Both sides are already battle-scarred from a cheese-based encounter earlier this year. Yes, seriously. So how big a financial impact could these moves have, and how frosty could relations get? Earlier, Simon Evanett, Professor of International Trade and Economic Development at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland, caught up with Monocle's Dominic Reynolds and Clemency Burton-Hill.
The Ukraine's got quite a lot at stake here. They export about $350 million in vehicle exports to Russia. And the Ukrainians have said, well, if Russia can do this, we can do it as well. In fact, I think this is just a pretext to a negotiation, because the Ukrainians have hinted that they would actually just like the Russians to waive the fee for them, this new utilization fee for them, and keep it on everybody else's imports of cars. Now, this, of course, won't go down well with all of Russia's other trading partners, and probably violates the WTO rule, which says that if Russia imposes a fee on one country, it has to impose the same fee on all the other WTO members. So the Ukrainians, I think, are trying to set up a negotiation to get the fee eliminated for themselves, and it will be interesting to see if the Russians will go for it.
As Dominic mentioned there, this is only the latest in a series of spats after, well, he mentioned the cheese-based issue earlier in the year. But in terms of the wider political situation, what do you think the implications are for Russia and Ukraine?
Well, this is part of a Russian strategy to reassert, I think, economic influence and possibly control over its neighbouring countries. And Russia has had a number of disputes and battles on the trade front with countries like Belarus, Kazakhstan, who they've managed to persuade to join a customs union with them. And the Russians clearly want the Ukrainians to join this so-called customs union as well. And so it's all part of a Russian attempt to reassert its economic influence in that region. And they use whatever tools they can, whether it's cheese, automobiles, or the most biggest one of all is the gas, the use of gas supplies as a weapon.
And where does all of this leave the Ukraine? Because it's sort of being pulled by both sides, isn't it? On the one hand, there is this sort of this post-Soviet customs union with, you know, with Belarus and Kazakhstan, as you said, and then on the other hand, Ukraine's looking for greater EU integration as well. So, how difficult is its situation?
The Ukrainians are torn, really, between looking east and west. I think the current government's probably looking a little more willing to look east than the previous one. They're also, in some sense, wanting their cake and eat it. They want to have great relations with the Russians and also have a trade deal with the EU, which is somewhat unlikely. So they're a bit, to be frank, they seem to be very conflicted in what they're doing. And, of course, that reflects the fact that within the country they're very divided on these issues as well. So I think it's a lot of uncertainty, quite frankly, for Ukrainian exporters who can find themselves as pawns in this particular battle.
I mean, you've suggested that the Ukrainian side is really a threat to try and generate a negotiation. But if they did go through with it, which side really would be worse affected by these sort of car taxes in inverted commas? And how important is the auto industry on both sides?
Well, the auto industry is very important, or more important, I think, on the Russian side. The Russians export about $450 million to the Ukrainians on the vehicles, and as I said, the Ukrainians export $350 back. So the Russians are a bit more exposed, but there's a wrinkle here in that many of the Russian exports to the Ukraine are, in fact, from Korean plants and German plants and French plants based in Russia. So this would draw in those countries as well. So the Ukrainians taking action against the Russians would actually affect probably their trade relations with those three other much larger trading nations as well. And so I think this all balances things out a bit. I think both countries have quite a lot at stake. The Ukrainians would be very nervous about upsetting their European trading partners by hitting Russian exports, some of which are made in Western European plants inside Russia. So it's balance and it's not trivial. I mean, this is quite a large exchange of goods and services.
That was Simon Evenett talking to Clemency Burton-Hill and Dominic Reynolds. In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be asking what state the corporate art market is in. We'll ask who gained and lost from the dot-com bubble, and we'll also be scaling a 3,000-foot climb to hear about the high-altitude hotel causing some drama in the French Alps. But first, here's Jonathan with the headlines.
Thanks very much. The Arab League chief, Nabil El Arabi, has said today that the new international envoy to Syria planned to take a different approach to his predecessor in a bid to bring an end to the ongoing conflict there. He said that Lakhdar Brahimi planned a period of careful study before beginning any negotiations. In South Africa, a jubilant group of miners who were arrested following clashes with police at Lonmin's Marikana mine have been released today after appearing in the local magistrate court. The group of 102 men were freed without having to post bail, but will appear in court again on the 12th of February. New Zealand's foreign minister has defended his country's own proposal for the marine protection area in the Ross Sea region today. Following criticism from environmentalists, Murray McCulley said that New Zealand is pushing ahead with an independent proposal for the marine reserve after it pulled out of a joint plan with the United States. Colombia leaders have held a news conference in Cuba's capital, Havana. The largest guerrilla group in Colombia, the FARC, will propose a ceasefire upon meeting with government officials for peace talks in Oslo next month. And President Barack Obama will begin his argument for re-election in Charlotte, North Carolina tonight in a high-profile closing act at the Democratic National Convention that he will use to spell out his plans to revitalize the stumbling U.S. economy. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from London here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is 18:32 here in the UK. Well, before the news, we heard from one battered airline trying to save its fortune. But for another, Air India, the future is looking increasingly bleak. The airline is reportedly planning to have its art collection valued, which includes works by the modern Indian master M.F. Hussain, often referred to as the Picasso of India, in an effort to raise revenue for the company. Air India hasn't turned a profit in 6 years. It's not the first time we've seen corporate buyers ditch their canvases in stricken financial times. Alitalia sold some of its collection in 2009, and numerous banks are rumoured to have cashed in their cultural stock when the financial crisis hit a few years ago. So, who are the big players in the corporate art market nowadays, and how much influence does this sector have compared to individual collectors? I'm pleased to say, to answer this question, we're joined now by Jane Morris, editor of the Art newspaper. Welcome, Jane.
Hello.
Can we tell who the big corporate buyers are these days? Because obviously, you know, the banks sold off an awful lot during the last recession. Do we know if they're buying stuff back? Who's really sort of making a play?
Well, I think the first thing is we need to be clear, which is often very unclear, what the distinction is between an individual collector and a corporate collector. Some of the biggest collections that you could argue are corporate collections are built by individuals with family businesses. So two that come straight to mind that I would consider really major players on the international scene is the Fondation Prada, which is Mucia Prada. She is a huge collector, her and her husband. We don't know the value of their collection, but I think we could safely say, conservatively say, that it's in the tens of millions and probably more.
A fair amount.
Yes, I mean, somebody like Eli Broad, who the financier in the US, his collection is believed to be around the $1.5 to $2 billion mark. So some of these collections are really very substantial. So Mucia Prada is a big player. The Fondation Prada, which is the charitable arm of the Prada company, is planning to build a huge space near Milan to show the collection. She purchased the Simon Fujiwara frieze project that I think you might have all seen a couple of years ago. She's just gone and bought the Kirinholtz five-card stud. It's a really famous piece of performance art. So people like her are big collectors. And another one that springs to mind is Reinhold Wirth of the Wirth Corporation. Again, another family business. And he is, his collection, well, again, it's his must be well into the hundreds of millions at the very least. So Francois Pinault, Bernard Arnault, Louis Vuitton. So some of these people are major, major players. In terms of companies like banks, who used to be relatively big collectors, I think most people are taking a much sort of lower key stance now. I don't think it's great for a bank's image at the moment to be seen to be out there buying hugely expensive work. So somebody like Deutsche Bank, who, you know, do collect art, tend to collect now at the younger end.
And what does that do for the general market when banks, or in this case airlines, are trying to, you know, perhaps either they're not buying new art, or they're trying to get rid of some of the stuff they have?
Well, I think because the corporates, as I say, are not as powerful as the individuals, if we consider Prada as an individual rather than as a corporation, I think that in general the market would see them as a source of hopefully high quality work.
And so, you know, when you look at the case of, say, Air India, that's, you know, trying to sort of, you know, sell off what it is now, or thinking of selling off what it is now, is there ever a sort of an air of desperation around some of these sales when other collectors know that, oh, well, they're selling this because they have to?
Well, put it this way, you wouldn't ideally want to sell a large number of works by the same artist if you could possibly help it. I don't know if you saw the announcement today, but the Warhol Foundation has announced that it's going to sell off the remains of its collection, and the remains of its collection could be as many as 20,000 pieces, although they are mostly prints and drawings. That may help the market in the sense of the excitement around it, but in general, it doesn't, to sell large quantities of art by one artist. Some collections are so highly thought of that the name of the collector, like Yves Saint Laurent, actually increases prices, but in general, it's not something that you would do if you could help it.
And how we've seen in recent years, as the banks have perhaps taken a step back and some of the more traditional corporate buyers have perhaps been a little more reticent to step in, have there been new corporate buyers that previously haven't bought much that are picking up some of the slack?
I wouldn't say that so much. I think it's more that it's interesting that some companies that, well, let's take a couple of banks, Deutsche Bank and UBS, that did look like they were cooling a little on art. Deutsche Bank particularly began to look as if it was uncomfortable with the huge amount of art it had. It allowed the Städel Museum in Frankfurt to take on long-term loan some of the best parts of its collection. But they've actually been continuing to collect, and UBS the same. And it looks as if with certain banks, they are thinking that art has still got a good reputation at the very high end. Very high-end collectors usually are the sort of people that banks want as clients. And Deutsche Bank and UBS particularly, and HSBC, I think it would be fair to say, have been using the fact that they're collecting, that they have collections, that they sponsor art exhibitions to help attract in those very high net worth individuals, to use the jargon.
Yes, it certainly helps them in the long term where they try and build their business.
Yeah, and they're offering services to these people. They're offering lending against art. Some of them are offering advice on conservation and shipping to their clients.
Jane Morris, editor of Art Newspaper, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this to meet the man who's delved into finding out the winners and losers from the dot-com bubble. Stay with us.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the affairs section, we climb on board the USS George Washington to see why aircraft carriers still rule the waves. We head to Norway to visit the world's best officer training school. And I nip over to Brussels to interview Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO.
In the business section this month, we go inside the studios of America's leading camouflage designers. We take a look at the big businesses that have surprising defence interests. And we report on the major deals taking place at Farnborough this year. We also have our first Entrepreneur's Guide, a comprehensive look at how to set up shop. The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House, 2040 in Nairobi, 1840 here in London. We don't readily associate the internet with history. The tool that binds every place, person and ill-judged party photo was barely in existence 15 years ago. But like any success story starting out, its identity was built by a crew of trailblazers hatching harebrained schemes. What separates the zeros from the Zuckerbergs, the Friendsters, remember Friendsters, from Facebooks, is the ability to adapt and no small amount of luck. In his new book, Totally Wired, author and journalist Andrew Smith revisits some of those forgotten pioneers from the turn of the century. And he joins us here in Studio One at Midori House. Andrew, welcome to Monocle 24.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with those people we've forgotten. Who have we forgotten and why?
We've forgotten almost everyone from the first wave. I mean, it's rather fascinating when you think about it, because the internet feels like it's been part of our lives forever. I mean, I have two kids. They can't imagine life without it. But the web, the World Wide Web, only began in the very early 90s, sort of 1992. Almost no one was on it at that point.
Well, most of us can still remember the moment where we got the internet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in 1994, at the beginning of 1994, there were 600 websites in the world. There were about 25,000 people online. It was nothing.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, it from about 1995 onwards, it just surged forward. And at that point, we all began to get it. And afterwards, we couldn't imagine the world without it. But it's so recent. This is only 15, 16, 17 years.
Now, I mean, we all remember the dot-com bubble in terms of what happened, or what happened, rather. But some of the characters involved in that have sort of, to a certain extent, been lost to history. And in this book, you do try and track down some of them and recount their stories.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the really fascinating things was that when the crash came, and the crash came in sort of March, April 2000, almost the whole sector, the whole of Web 1.0 and those first dot-coms was wiped out. Within 9 months, there were almost none left. A few survived, like Amazon, but people really thought they were going to go down. Mm. And other than that, they all disappeared and went off to nowhere. And some of those early companies were really fascinating. I mean, Totally Wired focuses mostly on New York because it was just a lot more interesting than Silicon Valley and California, where it was mostly about writing software. But in New York, there was a group of mostly unemployed sort of arts graduates and hipsters downtown who couldn't find jobs because there was a massive recession, and they gradually began to find the internet, and it spread amongst them. There was this tiny group of people who were about 30 or 40 to begin with who got it, and they were the early enthusiasts and the connectors. And so when it started to become clear this really was going to be something big, and they called themselves the early true believers, or cyber slackers, they were the ones who were at the forefront. So they went from being penniless downtown bohos to suddenly running companies worth millions and millions of dollars. And some of them ended up being worth hundreds of millions.
And some of them ended up penniless once again.
They ended right back where they started. That's the really fascinating thing. But in the meantime, they had 5 years of this just wild ride. I mean, the guy I focus on in the book, who's sort of the spine of the book, because I was fascinated when the crash came, the story was all these kids had been in charge of the companies. They'd all been stupid and squandered it on first-class air travel and expensive office chairs. It never quite convinced me. I didn't believe you could wipe out a whole sector of industry, a new industry, just like that.
You can try.
You could try, and they did, but I just didn't believe they could do it. So my question at the beginning was, what really happened? What really happened to that whole sector that went out?
Wasn't part of it that actually they weren't as rich as they thought they were in the first place?
Well, this is interesting because it was most of them were rich in terms of shares. Mm. Some of them did make cash. The guy who's at the center of the story I'm telling, who provides the spine around which everything else...
This is sort of Josh Harris.
Josh Harris was a really fascinating character because his money was real. He was probably the first internet millionaire in New York. He saw that right back at the end of the 1980s, before the web even existed, he just had this preternatural sense that it was the power of the internet was going to be about connecting people, not really about commerce or media, which is what most of the other kids thought it would be about, and business when it came in. And so he founded this internet research company called Jupiter Communications, which by 1993 was the world leader in its field. So he was genuinely worth a lot of money. He sold some of the shares, and he got bored with that and went and hired this, he leased this huge six-story warehouse at the edge of Broadway in Houston, and just started a company. They didn't even know what they were going to be doing. He just collected interesting people and put them in this space. And the idea was to try and transfer this thing that he saw in his head, which was what the internet and cyberspace were going to become, and make it physical into this space, and then put it online as well. So they very quickly became known. I mean, it's a whole bunch of young people doing whatever they wanted. So they very quickly became known for parties, which would have often 3,000-4,000 people in the space, and thousands queuing up outside, stopping traffic in Broadway, and doing all kinds of outrageous things. The biggest one he's most famous for was called Quiet, ironically titled. And it was their Millennium Party. It lasted through the month of December 1999. And he hired two warehouses, disused warehouses, down the end of Broadway, and got a community of 100 people to come and live in them for that period of time, each with their own Japanese-style hotel pod, each connected with their own video camera, so they were effectively their own TV station. You could flick between the channels, so they could all watch each other, and they could all be their own show, and they had as much drink, drugs, anything they wanted, absolutely anything went. There was a shooting gallery, a firing range in the basement, I think the idea was to connect them with their primal selves.
Yes.
And you could hear the shooting from out in the street. So after 9/11, of course, you'd never be able to do this. It was the last one. And it was shut down on New Year's Day, raided by the Federal Emergency Management Agency in a rifles-toting SWAT team.
Now, all these sound like interesting ways of spending money.
Yeah.
But not necessarily making money. How did Josh Harris actually make his money then?
Well, they had good investment from companies like Intel and the Tribune Group and Deutsche Bank. And what they did, they started out being about... Well, chat was the big thing on the early internet, which was real-time talking, you know, chatting between people. And he actually struck a deal, a very, very clever deal, the first one that was done in Silicon Alley in New York, to host, manage the chat sites for the biggest online provider, Prodigy, they were called. And pretty soon his chat rooms had 25% of the traffic, because the old ones, it was a very conservative company, so their chat rooms had titles like Macrame and Connecticut, and Josh came in with Mary's Parlor and Single and Looking and stuff like that. And so he made real money with that, and then set up as a netcaster. So they had a 30-channel, basically online TV station, trying to get that established online and getting people used to the idea, about 10 years ahead of its time, of putting up their own content onto the web. So he was trying to do YouTube.
Mm. Talk us through briefly how he came from then having this peak, being worth, what, $80, $85 million?
Yeah, $85 million
And the then going to pretty much nothing.
Well, what happened with him, which is, I think, the thing that makes him most interesting for me, is that most of the other kids running the companies, I say kids, most of them were in their 20s. I'm allowed to do that at my
age.
But most of the young people running the companies, most everyone else, were very spangly-eyed about the internet. It was going to be this amazing thing which was going to remake society. They felt as though they were in the 60s, you know, at the front of this revolution. Well, Josh's view of the internet, as the 90s went on, began to darken, and he started to see that as we were connecting in virtual space and able to interact anonymously and so on, that there would be a downside to this. And what he was trying to do with his experiments like Quiet was to illustrate that and to show us what could happen. And so he did this ever more extremely, and he spent a lot of his money on that. And in his last experiment, he actually, the dot-com crash actually caught up with his first company, and his shares tanked. So he lost most of his money while he was having a breakdown in this online environment where he and his girlfriend had decided to live online in his opulent Broadway loft for 100 days. They split up. He lost his money. He had a breakdown. He disappeared. That was it. End of the ride. And really, the last time anyone could do that kind of thing in New York, you simply couldn't do it now.
And has he been quite happy to talk to you about all of this? And his friends and his colleagues and so on have been quite happy to go over what happened?
Yeah, mostly. Josh is really fascinating because he lives in that kind of virtual space, I think, already that we're moving towards. I mean, one of the themes of the book, that one of the things that really interested me about wanting to do it, was the way that we see this all around us, the way that our physical lives and the physical world and the world of imagination, the more virtual world, are beginning to blur and mix, and it's becoming harder to tell the difference between the two. Now, Josh has always lived in that world. He's a very eccentric man, and that's the one thing everyone says about him. One of the brightest people I ever met, one of the strangest people I ever met. So he was trying to decipher and decode him was a real job, and there were lots of times I thought he's just playing me. I'm off in his virtual world, or am I? I don't know. And that's one of the things I most loved about doing it, actually. Frustrating as it was sometimes.
I can imagine. Andrew Smith, thank you very much indeed.
Total pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The book is Totally Wired and it's out now. We're going to be heading to the Alps in a moment to find out about a hotel. But to take us there, this is Of Monsters and Men with Mountain Sound. That was Of Monsters and Men with Mountain Sound. You're listening to Midori House. The Refuge de Gautier is no ordinary hotel. Built on the slopes of Mont Blanc, 3,000 metres above sea level, its construction has, understandably, been fraught with difficulty. the 100-strong team chosen to build the task was especially chosen for the task with endurance in mind. Thanks to the weather conditions, work could only take place between spring and autumn. The design, too, had to take into account the conditions. The architects hope it will be able to withstand winds of up to 3,000 kilometres per hour. And now the opening has been delayed, thanks in part to a political dispute between the local mayor and the Alpine Club over who will fund the inauguration ceremony. I'm joined on the line now from Paris by Ben McPartland, who's been covering this story. Ben, welcome to Midori House. This doesn't sound like the easiest of projects, does it?
Hi, no, it certainly wasn't. It took 5 years in the design and planning. Another three, well, it'd be 3 years by the time it's open, three summers and three autumns to build it, because they could only obviously work during the summer season and early autumn. And it's not quite complete. They've had a few hiccups. So yeah, it's not been the easiest projects for the French and the Club Alpine Français to get off the ground.
Let's talk about the most recent problem. This sort of dispute between the local mayor and the Alpine Club, which has also now involved the sports minister of France as well. Explain to us a bit about what's been going on.
Yeah, I think the mayor of the kind of the territory, the local town, Jean-Marc Pélix, and the Club Alpine Français, who will own the building. I don't think they're the best of friends. I think, you know, the local mayor has been concerned for a while about the kind of the numbers of people going up to Mont Blanc and especially staying in the former Refuge Gautier, which was frequently overpacked. So there's kind of been a history of discontent and kind of wrangling between the two. And I think it kind of finally came to a head when they were kind of discussing the final details of the opening, the inauguration, which they had a row over who was going to fund it. The mayor wanted, I think, €15,000 from the Club Alpine Français. I think they were only willing to put up €10,000. So, you know, one of the reasons it's been delayed, I think the kind of line that the mayor and the Alpine Club are giving is that they've had these technical problems, but the other line is that they've just had a bit of a fallout over the inauguration, and that's why it's not going to take place this summer.
Now, you mentioned there that obviously the mayor's concerned about the numbers of people who are going up Mont Blanc who've been staying at the old Refuge de Gautier. Is there a worry that sort of, you know, the more hotels like this, you know, that there are, the more it's going to attract greater numbers?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been dubbed the high altitude hotel kind of because it's got all the mod cons and because of the cost of the building. It's very much a mountain refuge for the, you know, the climbers, the experienced climbers who are going to take on Mont Blanc, the summit, of which there's around 25,000 each year. So yeah, there's growing concern. I think the concern has been growing for a number of years now, and every time there's an accident, you know, or a death, you know, high up on the slopes, it becomes even more of a controversy. And I think in July, 9 climbers, in fact, 11 in 1 week died, and because of an avalanche. I mean, the avalanche was impossible to predict, but because there was so many on the summit that day, you know, it killed, you know, a higher amount than it would have if the numbers were limited. So this is a major problem for the Alpine industry down there. You know, the local companies don't want any limit put on the numbers because for them it's big business. You know,
right.
When someone wants to climb Mont Blanc, there's a lot of expense goes into it. You know, in equipment and training and guides. But the local mayor says, well, look, it's my jurisdiction. It's my responsibility to protect the safety of tourist climbers who come into my area.
And who would want to argue with a local mayor? Ben McPartland, thank you very much indeed. Sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. That is all for today's Midori House. The producer was Katie Bilbao, researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and the studio manager, Chris Fitch. The Urbanist is up next after the news. Then we've got the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours London time. Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson are there for that. The news is next. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.